Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The name Florence Foster Jenkins may not mean much to many people, but for much of the first half of the last century, she was a sensation in more ways than one. She was a socialite who featured herself as an operatic singer. She was tone-deaf and, as one critic put it, unburdened by talent. Nonetheless, she staged frequent recitals. Her story is the stuff of legend and comedy and the basis of Max and Louis Productions' presentation of Souvenir, which opens tonight at the Marcel Theater in Grand Center. Joining me to talk about Ms. Jenkins and Souvenir are Sidney Grossberg-Ranga, the director and co-founder of Max and Louis Productions. Paul Cherugino plays the role of Mrs. Jenkins' pianist in the show. Thank you both so much for being with us. Have we stopped laughing yet?
Yes, we have. We are a little used to hearing those recordings at this point.
Sidney, this seems like wonderful fodder for a comedy.
It is. She's a fabulous character, but what's interesting to me about this play, as funny as she is and as wonderful as she is, and we are all deeply in love with her at this point, is that this play is really Cosme's journey, her accompanist. And it's based on him, although his journey varies greatly from the actual Cosme in the play. But it's the play talks about art and how we as artists deal with it and how it is perceived by others and what makes the rules. So that's really intriguing to me. It's it's also, this play is kind of a love story, not a romantic love story, but how these two people learn to love each other as artists and grow together and how they affect one another.
Yeah, she really had this superhuman ability to be able to do what she loved without doubting herself or without kind of getting too hard on herself, which is something that she was able to kind of pass on to Cosme, because he's someone that's a little bit more crippled by self-doubt and how he's perceived and the things that people say about him and the music that he tries to make.
That, of course, Cosme, of course, is your role.
Yes, that's right.
My understanding is that he went into this whole thing with her with a great deal of doubt and was not beyond laughing at her himself, but that he really grew very, very attached to her.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that she was probably one of the most important relationships that he had in his life. I mean, it's certainly to a certain degree that our version of the story may be a little bit different about how Cosme's life ended up in real life. I think, but in our version, I mean, she really changed the way that he could fundamentally do the things that made him happy and chart his own happiness in contrast to, like, you know, how he thinks that he should be happy or what he should do with his life.
Yeah. Sidney, this is billed as a fantasia, and that's new to me. What exactly are we talking about here?
Well, unlike the movie that came out a few years ago,
Meryl Streep,
this is not a biopic. It's based in these two characters, but this is a fantasia in that it goes off in different directions. We are not in any way trying to imitate Florence Foster Jenkins. Mm-hmm. It's more of an homage to her, what we do. Debbie Lennon is pretty spectacular and has really created a character that is so well-rounded and crazy silly and crazy lovable that it's kind of overwhelming to watch the two of them build a relationship and to watch. And so in terms of the fantasia, which is what you asked about, we aren't trying to tell her life story. We're taking her life and that character as a basis to explore how someone like that might affect others, especially those in the arts, and how in many ways she encouraged certainly Cosme, but I suspect others who grew along with her. She was quite a remarkable lady. As silly as her singing thing might have been, it brought a lot of fun to a lot of people and still does.
It does. And then I think also part of the Fantasia thing is that it's kind of a lot of different events kind of rolled into one, because the play in of itself is, it's like a jazz cabaret act. It's a classical recital gone awry. It's a comedy. It's a moth event, like all kind of wrapped into one little package.
This has got to be difficult for a singer like Debbie. I mean, she does sing in the production. And she's got to sing like that, like what we've been hearing.
Well, yes, and we worked on exactly how to do that a lot, because we don't want to try and imitate her, although she has found a lot of ways in which to sound like that. But the reality of creating that sound, because what was so interesting about her is, as she heard herself, she sounded good. And so, and the comment often was about how much feeling she sang with. Mm-hmm. So when we started working, Debbie sang beautifully. Now, a lot of the stuff that Florence sings is not really Debbie's kind of stuff to sing, but we worked on it, singing it with all the correct feeling and emotion, so that then when she veered off vocally, the underpinnings of that feeling, which was what was so important, or is so important to the character in this play, are there, which makes it even more wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, she really performed really kind of well. She just didn't get the notes right.
Well, let's give another listen in case people missed how we started. This is the laughing song from Strauss's Die Fledermaus. But she sold out. When she had these recitals, they were very well attended. She played Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, she did. And I mean, and it was all for the benefit of the charities that she supported. I mean, she raised a lot of money for the arts. She raised a lot of money for very good causes. Causes.
She was, I mean, the Carnegie Hall concert was to raise money for the armed forces. You know, she really was a good human being.
She sold out 2,800 seats, and they turned away 2,000 more.
One of the things I'd heard was that she sold out largely because of the charity work she did, and many of the people who attended were recipients of her good works. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it, too.
Yeah.
I read a story, and you probably know a lot more about this than I do, but I became fascinated at once having heard her. There was a story that Cole Porter attended one of her recitals. Yeah. And that he had to jab his cane into his big toe to keep from laughing.
Yes, that's a fairly famous. I mean, most of the smart famous people came to hear her. She was a big part. She was in the midst of society of the day. You know, everybody came. The people in the know came because of who she was and what she was doing, but also because it was fascinating.
Well, sure. It was entertaining
as
well.
It was. Maybe sometimes for some people for the wrong reasons, but no matter what, it was a good time.
Mm-hmm. People attended by invitation only.
At first. Eventually she opened, I believe, opened things up a little more. Also, she founded a society, a club called the Verde Club, which became really important. They they actually placed the statue of Verdi in Verdi Square, which is right near where I live in New York. Mm-hmm. So I see it all the time and now look at it with whole new eyes.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the whole thing is not unlike, you know, seeing like a reality star that decides they're going to go into music. You know, there's this spectacle of the fact that there's this fabulous person that then thinks that they can do something that maybe that they're not suited for. And it's just so kind of thrilling. And yeah, yes, funny, but kind of thrilling and really incredible to watch.
As a piano player yourself, Paul, when you listen to these recordings, the actual recordings, what do you make of the accompaniment, Cosme?
I mean, hear a great musician, and he was a great musician. In fact, what you don't hear in these recordings, because I think they picked the ones where they had the less problems, is that he could change keys in the middle of a song. He could transpose at any time because he had to follow her because she detoured off to some other key. And so he's like, okay, this is what we're doing now. I got to make it fit. Dun, 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 dun. Okay, we're now up like a major third now. Great.
You got to be paying attention when you're working with someone like this, don't you?
And she keeps me on my toes too because she'll switch things up on me.
Yes. Yeah.
And she should because, I mean, that's what she did.
Yeah.
So
it must be a lot of fun putting something like this together. I can tell by just talking to both of you.
Oh, my God.
You're getting a big kick out of it.
We were very blessed. Max and Louis takes very good care of us. And our rehearsal space was fabulous over at Muni Opera. And it was just usually the four of us in the room, me and Paul and Debbie and our fabulous, fabulous stage manager, Nathan. And we would laugh so hard sometimes. We just had to, like, take a moment to breathe again. We would have so much fun.
Is it a two-person show?
Yes. Yep.
Oh, I thought it was more than that.
It's
about that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
She was known for throwing flowers to the audience.
Yes.
Did any of that in the production?
No, that's not something we're doing, although it is a really funny story, but it's not part of Temperley's vision for this evening. Because like Paul was saying, we start with Cosme in the 60s performing, and it's the anniversary of her death. Mm-hmm. And he's distracted and ends up telling his story to his supper club audience, who came expecting to hear witty repartee and singing and got a whole other event.
However, we are faithful to what happened in the Carnegie Hall concert in that she has a new costume for every single song that she performed. And they are beautiful. They're made by Teresa Doggett, and they were just incredible.
But she made her own costumes, as I understand it.
I don't know.
I'd read that.
I think she had them made. I think she designed them.
Yes.
She had the concept and had them made. I don't think she sat and sewed. I can't imagine her sitting still that long from what I've read about her.
But she put on a good show.
She died in, I think, 1944. Was that correct?
Yes. Not long after that Carnegie Hall concert.
Right. Let's listen to another clip. They're irresistible. I can understand why people would
do this all day.
Well, people would go. The one we have here is Queen of the Night, the Queen of the Night aria from Mozart's the Magic Flute. I think there are a lot of dogs in our listening audience who are cowering under the bed right now.
Well, it's interesting. I have not you know, as I started to work on this, I listened to her a lot. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, I had to stop because we want to create, it's a Fantasia, we want to create our own Florence and our own sound. And Debbie has a much richer sound to her voice than Florence. So we needed to work with what we have.
Sure. Paul, I was interested in hearing you as we were listening to that last number saying, you said on a number of occasions, she's almost there.
She is almost there. She gets really, really close. She's like, sometimes she's just like 2 cents under, and sometimes she's like a third under, but, you know, we all try our best.
Well, yeah, we should.
She did.
Anyway, she didn't really quite get that she was as bad as she was. You indicated earlier, Sydney, that she kind of thought she was on track.
Yes, yeah. She felt, because more and more people wanted to hear her. I mean, you know, what would you believe if everyone wanted you to do things like play Carnegie Hall, have an additional concert? Oh, we want to bring this in. Oh, please come record for us. Mm-hmm. You know, what would you think?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we talk a lot about, in the play, about was it a delusion, was it madness? But having a love and being able to do what you love may have just been
to be loved for it.
Right. May have been so intriguing to people that in and of itself brought audience.
You say, was it madness? That brings to mind another element of her story, and that is the fact that she had syphilis.
Yes. Yeah.
Her husband infected
her. Which may have affected her ability to hear herself.
Which may literally have made her unable to hear herself. Because as a child, Florence was a prodigy, a piano prodigy.
Great musician.
I wanted to bring that up, the fact that she taught piano and was a prodigy.
Well, as a child, she was. I mean, they thought she was going to do great things.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Paul, how that might have affected her relationship with her accompanist.
Yeah, I don't know. Character. I mean, I think that she appreciated a musician, especially one that was just starting off when they first met. And so she really wanted to help him cultivate his skills, and I mean, he was also a composer, so she wanted to help him create his own body of work and get him and make him, you know, as famous as she could possibly get. So she always wanted to bring him along for everything.
What is the source material for this? And how well did whoever wrote
Stephen Temperley wrote the script, and he wrote a beautiful script.
I understand that, but is it factual? Is the relationship factual?
It's a fantasia. It is based in a factual relationship, but it is. But he's using that relationship, as so many playwrights use relationships that were real, to tell a story that's interesting to him and that's really interesting to us about artists in the world.
What is the significance of the title, Souvenir?
I've thought about that a lot. I mean, there is a reference to the line that refers to the title in the play is when she's talking about making her first record, which in the play is Queen of the Night, and I believe was actually her first record. And she talks about it being a lovely souvenir to have.
And I think the title kind of makes light of what you get from something to remember it. And so what he got from her was this ability to find his own happiness. And I think that's the souvenir that we're ultimately talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of doing a lighthearted version of that.
How has your opinion, I'll start with you, Paul, how has your opinion of her changed from the time you first were maybe approached for this role and began to hear about her and now having been living with it for a while? Is it different?
It is. I mean, the first time I ever heard Florence Foster Jenkins was I was in a music class at the Missouri Fine Arts Academy, which I think is a program that's now, unfortunately, it's been defunded. Was this incredible program. I got to hear, they played a recording of her, and we all laughed, and it was a great time, whatnot. And that's really as much as I've seen of her until the Meryl Streep movie came out. And so I think now that I've been in the play, I mean, it really is. She is kind of amazing in that. Was she a great singer? No. Was she a good performer? I think probably yes. And was she courageous? And did she do what she loved? And should all of us try to do just that? Then absolutely.
It brings to mind what you've just said, brings to mind a line, whether she knew how good or bad she was. She at one point said, and I think it was close to the time of her death, "They may say I couldn't sing, but they can say I didn't sing."
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's right.
And it's a really wonderful thing. I mean, granted, she had the financial support to allow herself to do that. It wasn't like she had to earn a living, which many of us don't have that behind us, you know. But many of us. But, you know, she did take – she put all of that to good use, not just for herself, but for a greater good, which is incredibly admirable. I really knew almost nothing about her going in. I'm not an opera person, so I luckily our stage manager does a lot of opera, and he gave me a quick tutorial in opera. I didn't really know of her, and I didn't see the Meryl Streep movie, nor did I see the show when it was in New York. I thought about it because it sounded like a blast, but it was just not, you know, when you live in New York, you pick and choose what you get to see.
did your opinion of this woman evolve and change since you first was brought to your attention
so
and now?
Oh, so much. Yeah. You know, when I first read the play, I found her really intriguing. The thing is, there's a really loving portrait of her in the play. So my initial knowledge of her was from that point of view. At least for me, there is. Other people may read it differently. Mm-hmm. So then I started reading about her, and as you were saying earlier, when we were talking, there's lots of her on YouTube. There's lots there's lots being written about her. All of a sudden, you know, there are two plays, a movie. There was a movie in England. I mean, all in like a 10-year period. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, this resurgence of interest. But the more I work on and read about her, the more I love her.
What kind of a run did the play have in New York?
It ran for quite a while. It started off Broadway, I believe, and then moved to Broadway. I got a couple Tonys. It did well.
How do you stage something like this? You've got two people, essentially, a woman, a piano player, and a piano. What else?
Well, it's the piano. Mm-hmm. That's really tricky. You know, often when I work in St. Louis or in New York and I'm in a black box space, I like to get the audience all around us. Mm-hmm. But when you put a grand piano in the middle there, you really can't. So we really pretty quickly established Duncey Dye as our designer, and we talked right away about, I don't think we can put audience on the side. Somebody's going to get totally... Well, they're not going to be able to see over a piano. But there's something lovely about two-handers because you get to focus all your attention. It does mean you have to move people around a little more than you might, but it's fun working with two people.
Is there a lot of singing?
There's a fair amount of singing.
We both do it.
Yeah.
Everyone in the play has got to sing.
Limited time left, just a few seconds. But, Paul, what is tougher for you? Is it the dialogue or the playing of the piano?
I think the hardest part for me, I think, is acting while playing the piano. And wanting to be a good musician and also realizing they have to be a good scene partner at the exact same time.
Is there, while you're playing, is there a lot of dialogue?
There's not so much dialogue, but in the fact that during the Carnegie Hall concert, I have to be engaged with what's going on with her because there's a lot of information you get from just, you know, what is going well and what is a complete derailment of what's happening by how I'm reacting to it. So that's split my attention.
Just sounds like a whole heck of a lot of fun. Oh. Max and Louis Productions of Souvenir opens tonight at the Marcel Theater in Grand Center, runs through the end of December. A lot of different dates and times. We'll have all of that on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Sidney Grossberg-Ronka, thank you so much for being
thank
with us.
You.
Break a leg, as they say. Same to you, Paul Cherugino. Hope you have a wonderful run through the rest of this month. Thank you so much for being with us. Maybe we can hear a little more as we say goodbye. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast. There she is at stlpublicradio.org/STL on air. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Alex Hoyer and Laura Hamden with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Char Dastin, and Spencer Reed. Executive producer is Mary Edwards. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.